Chapter 3. The Reverend Daughter, Heruhark Nona Jesimus, ought to have been the 311th Reverend Mother of her line. She was the 87th Nona of her house. She was the first Heruhark. She was named for her father, who was named for his mother, who was named for some unsmiling extramural penitent sworn into the silent marriage bed of the locked tomb. This had been common. Dreaber had never practiced resurrection purity. Their only aim was to keep the necromantic lineage of the tomb keepers unbroken. Now all its remnant blood was Harrow. She was the last necromancer, and the last of her line left alive. Her birth had been expensive. 18 years ago, in order to wrench a final bud from this terminal axle, her mother and father had slaughtered all the children of their house in order to secure a necromantic heir. Harrow had been created in that hour of pallor mortis, while the souls of her peers were fumbling to escape their bodies, her genesis their ignition of thanagy, as they died with a simultaneity her parents had agonized to calculate. None of this had been kept from her. It had been explained to Harrow year after year, right from the time she knew both when to speak and when to not. This skill came early to Ninth House infants. As a child, she was allowed to pull down the coverlet and get into bed only after she had worked her way through 45 minutes of evening prayers, bracketed by her wretched great-aunts Lacrimorta and Isamorta. They had been strict with her infant catechism, and their presence was a strong motivation for Harrow to get her prayers exactly right and not start over, as they smelled like incense and tooth decay. She had enunciated clearly, no lisping, devotions of their own devising.
"The tomb I will serve till the end of my days, and then see me buried in 200 graves,
which they'd thought sweetly whimsical. Just right for a little girl. Otherwise, Heruhark was left completely to her own devices. She would rise well before first bell and pray in the chapel before they turned on the heating, her fingers much too cold to count her prayer beads, and then she would ensconce herself in one of the libraries with a battery lantern and a blanket and her books. She embarked on her study of necromancy alone. The dead were her mentors and tutors. Harrow had no idea how difficult it was to understand the work of adult necromancers, which meant she did not fear trying to understand it. Her development suffered from neither ego nor apprehension. Her parents would sometimes have her recite her theorems of an evening, or make her conjure ulna bones from a skeleton ground up to powder, or they would have their elderly marshal, Crux, heave some recent corpse over the top tier to squash right to the bottom and have her fuse the bones back together blind, through the dermis and meat. Then they would open up the body to see how well or badly she had done, but either way their approval was mostly relief. In her genius, they had received the goods that they had so dearly paid for. Crux told her that her parents had been different once. This must have been before they committed a little light child massacre. Harrow had been dimly interested in this factoid. She could never recall her parents being anything but exhausted, their joy all spent. Her mother rarely spoke, or if she did, addressed all her remarks to their hulking cavalier, a man who looked as though he would weep if he could only figure out how. Her most vivid memory of her mother was of her hands guiding Harrow's over an inexpertly rendered portion of skull, her fingers encircling the fat baby bracelets of Harrow's wrists, tightening this cuff to indicate correct technique. Her father had been the more voluble of the two. In the evenings, he read to his little family, sometimes sermons, and sometimes antique family letters. That was another rare memory. The electric light strung up behind her father's chair. Her sat on a three-legged stool next to her mother, her father's voice a drone unceasing until a touch from his cavalier indicated that he might stop. Harrow would shrug herself inside her black hooded church robe and practice moulding tiny motes of bone between her finger and thumb, pressing them into soft fingerprints, mentally chopping her body into 200 relic pieces. Then everything changed, abruptly, forever. Harrowhark fell in love. Falling was not the right term, precisely. It was a long process. She more correctly climbed down into love, picked its locks, opened its gates, and breached its inner chamber. Her life had been dedicated to the locked tomb, and what was interred within had commanded her whole attention since she understood what it was. The comatose corpse that lay in state amid the tatters of the ninth house. She'd been taught to love the Emperor, who 10,000 years ago had given them all release from a death that none of them had deserved, and to view the tomb as symbol of his victory and his demise. Her mother and father feared what lay consigned to that locked-up grave. Her tedious great-aunts worshipped it, but in desperation, as though their collective awe might flatter it into sparing God. They had never wanted to open the doors and look upon it. Those doors had opened for the body to be brought in, and they would only open again for the body to come out, in some doom yet to come. Harrow was forbidden entry in the same way she was forbidden from going up to the top tier of the drill shaft and taking a hammer to the oxygen sealant machines. It would be the end. Most of her life was spent in silence. There were many moments when she found living difficult, tedious. On the worst days, fatuous. Memory now recalled what had happened very bloodlessly, and the details were unimportant. One very bad day, when it seemed as though everyone hated her, and as though this were a completely correct way to feel, with bloodied fists and a bruised heart, she wrote a note explaining her suicide, then went and unlocked the door. Unexpectedly, this did not kill her. And what did not kill her made her curious. She was much older before she could cross the threshold. It was trapped like all hell. But the traps were ninth traps, made of bone and grinning skeleton, and she'd been using them herself since she was toddling. In the end, the experience was merely educational. She crossed the cave, which was trapped, and passed the central moat of black water, which was deep and trapped, and then climbed the island, trapped, to the frozen mausoleum, ridiculously trapped. And when she got there, alive, she could look into the open-faced coffin where lay the reason for her existence. God's victory and death was a girl, maybe a woman. At the time, Harrowhark had not known how to tell, and the gender was only a self-interested guess. The corpse lay packed in ice, wearing a white shift, her hands clasping a frost-rimed sword, and she was beautiful. The formation of her muscles was perfect. Each limb was a carved representation of a perfect limb, each bloodless foot the lifeless and high-arched simulacrum of the perfect foot. Each black and frosted lash lay against the cheeks with perfect still blackness, and her nose. It was the pinnacle of what a nose should be. None of this would have broken Harrow's spirit, except that the mouth alone was perfectly imperfect, a little crooked, with a divot in the lower lip as though someone had softly pressed a dent into the bow with the tip of their finger. Harrow, who had been born for the sole privilege of worshipping this corpse, loved it wildly from sight. So the death of God had been Harrow's death too. She had been careless with her visits. Her parents had found out about what she had done, what manner of sin she had committed, and they reacted just as they might have if she had admitted to smashing up the oxygen sealant machine with a hammer. Faced with apocalypse, they chose to die by their own hands before another death could claim them. They weren't even angry. It was with a calm and earnest understanding that her mother and father and their cavalier tied 5 nooses, one for mother, one for father, 2 for Mortis, 1 for her. Then they hanged themselves with barely a gasp and barely a kick. It would have been better, really, if Harrow had hanged herself up beside them. It would have been best if she had crawled into the tomb beside the woman she loved and let the freezing temperatures take their course. But Harrow, who was 200 dead children, Harrow, who loved something that had not been alive for 10,000 years, Harrow Hark, Nona Jessamus, had always so badly wanted to live. She had cost too much to die. Love had broken her life into 2 separate halves, the half before she had fallen, and the half afterward. Afterward, she hated to sit in the apse during chant and listen to a weird thuddering beat disrupt the prayers of the faithful, a distant striking at the back of her head that she had taken for someone being out of time. She heard doors open and close in distant halls where no doors were opening or closing. Her body would become very frightened and her brain very frustrated. In her agonies, she would have to sit right beside her aging Marshal Crux, usually while being spoon-fed. He was insistent that she had to eat, and all the while she would demand, "Is that real?" for half of what she heard, and he could say, "Yes, my lady," or "No, my lady," and she might be content. It killed all her peace. Even in the long dark days she spent wholly alone, in the libraries or in her laboratory, fingers burnt from handling fatty ashes, she would hear voices just out of her hearing or see things in her periphery that were not there. It seemed to her that sometimes her hands would grasp her own throat and press up against her windpipe until she saw spots in her vision. She would see dangling ropes. She would forget where she was and wipe out a whole morning scholarship with false memory. In that first year after her parents' deaths, she often saw the body, when she was sleeping or when she was waking, and that was relief and frustration both. The body brought her total peace, but in its presence she lost track of time. She would sit with her hand very close to the dry, dead hand of her obsession, and when she looked up the hours would be eaten away, or she would check the time and be astonished and discombobulated that it had been only a few minutes. When her pituitary gland kicked in, the body stopped appearing when she was awake, but the other hallucinations kept on. Harrow was furious that she was doing something so pedestrian as to pubesce. But as puberty changed her yet again, with hormones or time or both, she was able to regain some semblance of control over her maggot-eaten mind. She prayed often. Her brain took refuge in rituals. Sometimes she fasted, or ate the same thing for every meal, arranged in a specific pattern on her plate, consumed in the same order for months on end. She wore her paint far beyond the strictures of any nun, wore it in private, sometimes slept in it. She found the sight of her own unpainted face in the mirror impossibly wearisome, monstrous and nonsensical, somehow far away and yet heinously attached to herself. Harrow did not often weep, but at times she sat within the shroud of her cot and rocked back and forth with hard, fast motions, often for hours. The scholarship grew difficult once she realized belatedly that it was difficult, but that was cured by working harder. She spent sometimes half a month on the same theorem. She moved her mother and father through the house like chess pieces, trying every year to correct their stiff and unnatural gait, sitting them in chapel as her people asked them for guidance she had little idea how to give. But the penitents and devoted of the locked tomb were getting old, and she learned that they all wanted to be told the same thing. More often than not, she would stand between her parents' corpses at some deathbed, watching one more of her penitents rattle their last as she repeated the words of their final service. They died happy. They loved it. She had a real talent. Harrowhark had attended so many deathbeds and given so many solemn takes about death and duty that in the end she started to believe them. The ninth house elderly became the ninth house decrepit, and the ninth house decrepit became the ninth house dead. Harrowhark was by most of them when they died, except if they had a sudden pulmonary, and even at 14, she was good enough with a heart arrest to keep them going until she could give them final rites. She'd always disdained flesh magic, but she had a knack for the aorta. Later, when their meat had trickled away, she personally raised their defleshed skeletons to work the mangle or quietly rake the snowleak fields in the upper reaches of Dreaber. Much of her necromancy had been sharpened by the day-to-day busy work of geriatric death, of the niche and the skull, of sitting with osteoporotic bones and filling up their honeycomb so that the constructs did not end up a confusion of rib cages with their legs powdering off. Her parents knew what they had been about, making a genius out of 200 dead children. It took a genius simply to keep the house from deliquescing into a pile of bones and pneumonia victims. But even a genius could only maintain the status quo. The house had never had the tech, nor the understanding, nor the on-duty flesh magicians to work a vat womb. The womb-bearing populace was too old to have babies, barring two of their number, one of whom was herself. Harrow could only thank God that duty had never fallen to her. The only viable source of healthy XY had been located in her house's Cavalier Primary, a boy 17 years her elder. Back then, she had considered him a walk-around mansuit surrounding some quite good calcium carbonate, and she knew he considered her with an awful respect, the same type one might have for a hereditary cancer that one knew was on its way. Thankfully, their marriage would have mingled the Dreaber Cavalier and Scion lines beyond any hope of repair. Ortus Nigenad was an only child. Harrowhark had her parents quash the idea so enthusiastically that she cracked her father's molar. The only virgin who could possibly be more relieved was Ortus himself. So the years passed, unshriven, crusting up and drying as they went. Harrowhark watched Crux get older and older and older, and tried all the tricks in her box to keep him upright. There was terrible plaque in his arteries, and he pretended that he did not notice her scraping them. She knew that when she finally laid her nursemaid in his niche, it would be the death of the only other person invested in her sanity. And if she went mad again, then what? At any point, she could have asked for assistance from her sister houses. At any point, she could have asked for cohort intervention, and they would have been there the next day with fetal care boxes and volunteer penitents and loans and plant samples, and with incontrovertible suggestions that Harrowhark really ought to marry this son of the second or this daughter of the fifth. and she could have watched coloured banners get strung up next to the black skull of the black anchorite, and that would be the end of the Ninth House, even more completely than a hammer to the oxygen sealant machine. They needed a resurrection. They needed a miracle. Harrowhark had been studying miracles for years, and then one landed squarely in her lap. The chance to become a lictor. The chance to serve the Emperor, her god. The chance to become a fist and a gesture. The chance to become an immortal servitor and advocate for Dreaba. To refresh the Ninth House on her terms, with the rock never rolled away and the love of her life and her death quiet and unmolested in her deadly shrine of stone. Another 10,000 years of solitude. Another long and snaking line of reverend mothers, reverend fathers. Harrow took the unready cavalier from her house, and she snatched the chance with both hands. But like falling in love the first time, becoming a lictor had all gone wrong. Her cavalier had given himself to her with a numb readiness that still burnt her to ash with shame. Even with that readiness, she had committed the indelible sin halfway. She had gathered up the matter of Ortus Nigenad's soul and not been able to choke him all the way down. She was Harrowhark alone in front of the mirror again. A nonsense. A monster. An alien geometry. A loathsome squawk of a person. She was 9 and she'd made a mistake. She was 17 and she'd made a mistake. Time had repeated itself. Harrow would be tripping over herself for her whole existence, a frictionless hoop of totally fucking up. There had been another girl who grew up alongside Harrow, but she had died before Harrow was born.